From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Pretty rough. We were restricted pretty much our community. There was no outlet for black entertainment. Parents kept you pretty close because they thought you'd get in some kind of trouble. This was the time of the Ku Klux Klan burning crosses. In fact, in my community in Droveland, they burned out 400 homes and raised them and chased them out of the community. People had to get hide in swamps, and it was a rough time coming up. And I was the first black child born in my family. Most of my cousins and brothers and sisters was light complected. My mother was light complected. My father was dark skinned. And even in my own family, you know, I was looked down upon because my brother had all the opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I had to pretty much do work with my father.
J. Paul Montgomery, author of Mama's Black Child, a veteran's memoir, self-published. From the orange groves in Florida in the 1940s to the U.S. Army in the 1950s through the 1980s, Montgomery fought prejudice for being a dark-complexed black man even within his own family. His U.S. Army service in communication operations and recruitment took him from Florida to Hawaii, Thailand, Germany, Vietnam, and Korea, as well as several stateside Army posts, a career that eventually ended with a diagnosis of depression and post-traumatic stress. In his book, Montgomery details his exploits, including being a bouncer in a nightclub in Germany, getting his car stolen on his first trip to New York City, and being assigned to a patrol car to assist D.C. law enforcement after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Johnny O. Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Mama's Black Child, a Veteran's Memoir, with author J. Paul Montgomery, In Black America.
I wanted to be an airplane pilot, and I thought that's where I could learn how to be an airplane pilot, because Tuskegee Airmen, at the time, Tuskegee Airmen was in Tuskegee. It was the Army Air Corps, and the Army had black pilots, so I thought I could do that too. But they didn't let me because my scores and everything wasn't high enough, and I wasn't a college grad, so I went into communication, and eventually, after I retook the test, got a higher score. In fact, it was called a GT score, General Technical. It had to be 110, and I retook it, and I came up with 115, so there was no limit to what I can do after that.
J. Paul Montgomery's life growing up in Claremont, Florida was no easy task. Deep down, he knew he didn't want to work in the groves for any extended period. Mind games was his greatest pastime, and he seldom played with his five brothers, or anyone else for that matter. He wanted to be an airline pilot in the U.S. Army. Montgomery's story is a compelling, unvarnished self-portrait of an African-American veteran in the fullest sense of the word. It's a story of a boy growing up in the age during Jim Crow era, a soldier and recruited for the Army who would spend 25 years in the service and would later become ordained reverend and founder of the nonprofit church organized to assist, aka Heroes, to expose African-American youth to becoming community heroes and provide positive role models for them. In Black America recently spoke with the father of four and grandfather of 14.
I was concerned about the black community, and I wanted the leaders of the black community to realize that there was lots of possibilities with our young kids, so I thought I'd write something to kind of shock their memory.
And tell them what it was like growing up in, was it Central Florida you grew up?
Claremont, Florida.
Tell them what was life like growing up, because we're going to get into some of the specifics in the book, but your early childhood there in Florida.
Pretty rough. We were restricted pretty much our community. There was no outlet for black entertainment. Parents kept you pretty close because they thought you'd get in some kind of trouble. This was the time of the Ku Klux Klan burning crosses. In fact, in my community in Droveland, they burned out 400 homes and raised them and chased them out of the community. People had to get hide in swamps, and it was a rough time coming up. And I was the first black child born in my family. Most of my cousins and brothers and sisters was light-complected. My mother was light-complected. My father was a doctor, was dark-skinned. And even in my own family, you know, I was looked down upon because my brother had all the opportunities, mm-hmm. and I had to pretty much do work with my father. We worked the orange groves, too. Picking oranges, that was real hard work. But I don't think I would lift up to expectations because I was kind of, I didn't like the idea of working for white folks in the orange grove.
And James was your older brother, the oldest?
Yeah, he was the oldest brother.
And where were you in that chain?
I was number four in the family. It was 10 of us. I was number four.
And your grandmother had 14 children, right?
Right. At 11 girls, and had three boys.
What made you think you could become a pilot?
Well, when I was 11 years old, I heard that I wanted to know if I saw airplanes flying. I was curious, who flew these things, man? I was wondering. I know, wondering if black people can fly an airplane. You know, I hadn't heard of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew of a man that was in the Army. He had a son, and I kind of inquired through him, that was the black airplane pilots. And he said, yeah, that was the Tuskegee Airmen in Tuskegee, Alabama, that was trained at Tuskegee Institute to be airplane pilots. So I thought if I joined the Army, I could become an airplane pilot. But I was mistaken. I joined the Army, and they said you had to have a college education, and you had to have a certain score. And my score didn't come up to par at that time. I retook the score, and I did come up to par. So, but instead of becoming an airplane pilot, I became a communications specialist, and eventually I became an intelligence analyst. And I think I enjoyed it more than I would have been an airplane pilot.
How did your father go about building a construction company?
Well, he started off doing barns in Georgia, and he started building houses for black people. And he built lots. He did almost all the houses in our community. Black. He had a white financier. He financed all the houses, and he gave my father a lump sum. Money, lump sum to build a house. And then on a Sunday morning, he came and collected the money for each month for the house that he built that was built. So it was between him and a rich white man that he became a builder. He didn't know too much about building until this white man came and said he thought he can do it. And he started doing it, and he was under the supervision of this white man. there was always a white man involved down in the South. There was almost nothing done without the permission and without the help of a white man.
I found it interesting, and part of the story, you talk about your father and his wheelbarrow before he actually got a truck.
Yeah, he did. He used to push his wheelbarrow when he was building houses, tools and everything. He built a wheelbarrow. It had an iron. Didn't have a rubber wheel on it. It had an iron wheel on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of hard pushing it through the dirt, but he built a wheelbarrow, and he pushed his wheelbarrow and carried his tools. And I remember him building all frame houses in all wood, had wood siding.
Mm-hmm.
And everything before he learned. After a while, he started laying concrete blocks, and he started building concrete block houses. And eventually, through the years, he eventually started building houses for white people. He learned how to do a blueprint, and he drew his own blueprint and took it over to a print press so it could be approved and sent it to the city so he can get a building permit. And he got his, and as he was building, the city told him he had to have a contractor's license to build.
Mm-hmm.
So they granted him a license, and he became a licensed contractor. He built lots and lots of houses. He was never without a house to build.
Him having that independence, what did that do for you as far as your thinking of being able to go it on your own?
Well, I worked with my father, and I pretty much learned the building trade. I probably could have been a builder, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to work for white folks. I just didn't see being supervised all the time. And I was told by my sisters and brothers, well, if you don't want to work white folks, you're going to be in the Army, somebody's going to be telling you what to do all the time. I said, well, I think I'll make sergeant pretty quick, and I'll be telling somebody what to do all the time. And sure enough, I did.
Now, you didn't go past the 11th grade because you went to work for your dad those 2 years prior to you going off to the Army. What did you actually do those 2 years? Was it all construction work with your dad, or did you go back and forth in the orange groves?
I stayed with my dad. My brothers and sister worked with my mother in orange grove.
Mm-hmm.
I was with my dad all the time.
And what were you all building then?
We were building black folks' houses. We were building country houses. I stopped pushing a wheelbarrow full of country, which was about 200 pounds, when I was 12 years old. You had to put a foot in there and had to come over the concrete floor, and I pushed wheelbarrows to get that concrete in. When it started at the age of about 12.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and we're speaking with J. Paul Montgomery, author of Black Mama's Child. Mr. Montgomery, when you decided to join the Army, why was that decision made right after your 18th birthday?
I wanted to be an airplane pilot, and I thought that's where I could learn how to be an airplane pilot, because Tuskegee Airmen was in Tuskegee.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Army Air Corps, and the Army had black pilots, so I thought I could do that too. But they didn't let me because I my scores and everything wasn't high enough, and I went to college grad, so I went into communication. And eventually, after I retook the test, we got a higher score. In fact, it's called a GT score, General Technical. It had to be 110. And I retook it, and I came up with 115. So there was no limit to what I can do after that.
When you went to join the Army, was it Eddie that went with you that first time?
Huh?
Was it Eddie that went with you the first time when you joined?
Eddie Bass, yeah.
What happened to Eddie?
We went in one of these X-rayed movies. We took some liquor, went in an X-rayed movie, and I think and we pretty much got drunk at age 18, messing around with looking at the X-rayed movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, when we went back to the motel was closed and we couldn't get in. We had to sleep in the car. And we hear noises and everything of people walking around. They was going to breakfast. We went to we ate breakfast adjacent to the motel where there was a black cafe to sit up to serve the recruits and to the applicants for the Army and Air Force and the Navy. They had a business there. We went there and we ate some grits and bacon and egg and sausages, and it was so good. I want to ask the lady, could I have seconds?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yes, son, you could have seconds. And that time, during that time, Muhammad Ali was coming along. He was fighting. Was that Sonny Liston? I think so. Anyway,
probably Sonny Liston. Yeah.
Yeah, Sonny Liston. Who did he fight?
The first fight to win the championship was Sonny Liston.
Yeah, Sonny Liston. Yeah. That's right. Everybody was talking about him at the diner.
Right. Now, I was interested when you all, you know, drove up in Eddie's car, and then I was wondering, okay, they're getting ready to go enlist in the Army. How they're going to get the car back, or what are they going to leave the car?
Well, we didn't know that we had to go to the reception station, to the Army reception station.
I got you.
The same day that we enlisted in the Army, we thought we could come back home.
Mm-hmm.
But Eddie, he
didn't do too well on the test, or didn't try to pass it.
He sit there and didn't do anything on the test.
Okay.
And so he didn't make it, and he had to come back home. So he went back home by himself.
So whatever happened to Eddie? Did you get a chance to see him,
Eddie,
on your return trips once you had furloughs?
Eddie was pretty much a woman's man. I mean,
he
chased women all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he pretty much came he worked in the orange groves, and he didn't live very long. He died when he was in his 50s, I think.
Now, when you first got to your first station, and you had problems with your first, I guess he's not your bunkmate, but you are in the same section of bunks.
Oh,
the guy from Mississippi.
I was already in basic training.
Okay.
And I had a big, tall guy from Mississippi that bunked over me. And he always called me nigger and get out of his way. And we don't allow your kind to be in the same place as us in Mississippi. And I put up with this for about 6 or 7 weeks. And one day, I decided, I kind of planned it out. On Thanksgiving, I was going to approach him, and I was going to fight him and so he can stop calling me nigger. And so I kicked the bunk. He was on top, and I kicked the bottom of the bunk. He jumped out, and by the time he jumped out, I kicked him, and I got him on the floor, and I beat him. I said, remember this kicking your butt. And after that, he didn't bother me no more.
Were there people of color that were officers or platoon leaders while you were in the Army?
Not when I was in basic training. Imagine. There wasn't. Eventually, I ran it out. The first time I saw a black officer was a captain.
Mm-hmm.
And I really was amazed, and he was. I was really excited about that.
And what year? What year are we talking about here?
1959.
And mm-hmm. also, it was interesting, on your subsequent trips, you enlisted and then you went back home, of the bus rides in which you had to take, in which interstate travel was somewhat segregated.
Yeah, it was segregated. You had to ride in the back of the bus, and the white folks got on and off before you did.
And how did that make you feel, considering that you were joining the Army to go help preserve freedom for other people?
I pretty much was accustomed to it since I was raised under Jim Crow laws and everything, and so it was normal. It was normal to me because that's the way I was raised, and I figured when I was on the Army base, I was equal to whites, but when I was off the base, I had to come back under Jim Crow laws. So I really didn't have a second thought about it. It was normal.
I found it interesting on your second. I'm jumping ahead. On your third enlistment, you drove to New York in your car.
Yeah, my car.
And how did you get played to the point where somebody had actually stole your car?
I went to check my car in, so I was going to ship it overseas.
Right.
And I left my keys in my car, and I had picked up a guy at the Poughkeepsie, New York, where there was an apple orchard where the blacks picked apples for a living. And I made friends with him. And we drove down to New York, and we went down on 125th Street, and I spent a day with him down there chasing girls and everything. And so when we got ready to go to the point of deportation, I let him and two or three girls go with me. And I left my keys in my car to go in and sign in, told him I was there ready to check my car in. And when I came back, my car was gone. And I got a look. I went to 125th Precinct Police station, and I told them about it, and they said, okay, we'll try to find your car. And we chased it for 3 days, and they couldn't find it, turned over to the FBI. And this first time, the first day, we found a car parked in the backyard of a place in around 125th Street, and the guy, the FBI said, "Is that your car?" I said, "Yes, it is." It was, well, it was pretty, it was shine, it was polished. They knocked on the door, and the people came out. And I said, he said, "Who's the one that took your car?" And I pointed him out, and he was arrested. And they took me down to the precinct, to the judge, and they told me that I had to sign a complaint. And this guy would probably he'll be charged with grand theft, and that I didn't have to wait for him to go to a trial, that they could do it as long as I signed the paper.
When did you start having knee and ankle problems?
When I went to jump school, airborne training, I really had knee problems before I got in the Army.
Okay.
Playing football, a guy clipped me from behind, and back in those days they didn't give you the right orthopedic, didn't take you to the orthopedic surgeons and anything like that, because they just kind of labored it along, and you had to do the best you can. And when I was in basic training, I sprained my ankle.
Right.
And when I was in airborne training, my ankle started swelling up and everything. But I was still trying to make it, and you had to go on 6 mile runs and everything in the airborne. And it just swelled up, and my knee swelled up, and I just could not. So I had to fall out. I couldn't make it in airborne training, so I was housed in the reception station for about a week. Then I was shipped to Hawaii, and I had surgery. When I got to Hawaii on my knee.
Now, it was interesting, while you were there in Hawaii, you received like 2 or 3 promotions while you were laid up in the hospital?
No, I just made one promotion. I made PFC.
And when did you make the other promotion?
When I got out of Hawaii, what I had to do when I first got out of the hospital, until my knee got strong enough to go back to communication, I was in charge of a POL dump where they filled up
tanks. Gas station, right.
Yeah, a gas station where we filled up the tanks and PCs, personnel carriers. And eventually I got strong enough so I can go back to my regular job of communication, which was climbing telephone poles and landfill wire and stuff like that, which was pretty rough. But I made it. I made sergeant.
How did you, because you talk about this in the book as far as, you know, those that, well, once you made it through basic training, those on the right are going to continue, those on the left, they're going to send you home. But how did they decide what type of job you were going to have in the Army? They just pick one?
That was based on the aptitude test that you took.
Okay.
You took a test, and whatever you excelled in, that's the field you went in.
Now, you had some trepidations going back home during the interim period because, like you said, it wasn't a whole lot to do. Most of the people that you grew up with, you missed that 2 years when you were working with your dad, having a good time with your family, and you had more in common with your brother-in-law than you did with your brothers.
Yeah. I think my family didn't want me to join the Army. My dad definitely didn't want me to join the Army because he needed the help and everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And being a dark-complected guy, I think they thought maybe a lighter-complected job would they send them to school, and I didn't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't go to college. In fact, I didn't even finish high school. So I always resented that. And so that caused somewhat of a separation.
Tell us about that Thunderbird that you first took over there to Germany.
Oh, man, that was something else. I had a big old 1960 Thunderbird in 1963. And those German girls, boy, they loved that Thunderbird. So I became a ladies' man with that car van.
How were you able to squeeze in being a bouncer at night and
when you was they needed bouncers in the clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 6'2", 195 pounds, and so I qualified to be a bouncer. I just threw guys to the door. If they was acting up, I was there to put them out of the club, and so that was no problem.
You talk a little bit about your experience in when you got to Vietnam, and then you saw certain things that really had an effect upon you. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I was an operations sergeant when I got to Vietnam. I directed where tanks and everything would receive the where they was needed at. I directed them how to get there on the map. And I did the KIAs and WAs, the killed in action and the wounded in action. I made it reports to our headquarters and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which was pretty hard. We had a reefer where we would put the bodies in so they wouldn't spoil in the area. And a couple of my friends was killed, and they came back, and I had to do the personal effects and send the stuff home to the parents, to the families and everything. It was pretty rough. Eventually, it led to PTSD, post-traumatic stress, when I got back it was several years later. It was pretty much, I think, when I got, I was 49 years old when I went to the hospital for post-traumatic stress, and I got my disability.
I understand that you were in or at Fort Meade when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated?
Yeah, Fort Meade. I was assigned to a police squad as a liaison and I was a radio operator, and I called. The radio with the Army was incompatible with the radio for the police. So I acted as a go-between to call the Army in for reinforcement when there was trouble at a certain location.
What effect did that have on you?
I really didn't like it a whole lot. At the time, Stokely Carmichael, Nate Brown, they was agitators and everything. And whenever one of those was in the area, we had to notify the headquarters that they was in the area.
J. Paul Montgomery, author of Mama's Black Child, a Veteran's Memoir. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.